Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, January 20th, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call, Running Aground in the Surveillance Safe Harbor. My name is Tim Courtney. I'm the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our experts, Stuart A. Baker, partner at Steptoe & Johnson LLP, Susan Foster, a member at Mintz, Levin, Cohn, Ferris, Golovsky, and Papeo PC, and moderating today's call is Matthew Hyman, who is the Vice President and Chief Compliance and Audit Officer at Tyco International. And with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Hyman. Mr. Hyman, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Tim, and thanks to Sue and Stuart for joining me today. I think everyone has the bio for Sue and Stuart. They were attached to the publicity and the emails for this teleform, so I would encourage you to take a look at those if you're interested in learning more about the background of our speakers. What I would say in summary is we've got two genuine subject matter area experts in this topic, and so I'm looking forward to a good conversation. So to get right into it, I'll direct my first question to Sue, and that is, with regard to the safe harbor, how did it work, and why, in your opinion, did the European Court of Justice decide that it was invalid in the Schrems decision last October?
Okay, thanks, Matthew. So the Safe Harbor Program was essentially an agreement between the European Union's Commission and the U.S. government that allowed for transfers of personal data from Europe to the U.S. And to understand why that was such an important program and why the consequences of the Schrems decision are so serious, you need to understand the legislative framework on data protection in Europe. So let's start with that. Back in 1995, the European Union, after many years of negotiation internally, passed a directive that was aimed at harmonizing European Union privacy laws. The directive was rooted in the European Convention for the Protection of Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms, and that's now instantiated in a Charter of Human Rights that was passed in 2012, right? So I'll refer to the Charter. If you look at the Charter, you'll see that privacy and the protection of personal data are separate, quote-unquote, fundamental rights, which becomes a very important thread to the entire discussion. The directive itself had two objectives. One was to protect this fundamental right of privacy and the protection of personal data, while also ensuring the free flow of data within Europe. So as most of you on the call will know, the European Union has, as one of its key aims, the reduction of internal barriers to any kind of trade within the European Union. The directive starts with a ban on processing. So starting with the idea is a fundamental right, they start with the idea that processing of personal data, and processing is a really broad term that means doing just about anything with personal data, you start with saying you can't do that. And then the law sets up specific conditions under which the data can be processed. So every time you're looking at a potential use of personal data originating in the European Union, you've got to find some basis under the law that allows you to do what you want to do with it. So one of the things that's important to understand about the directive and the new regulation that's coming in to replace it in about 2 years is that there's absolutely no imperative to ensure the free flow of data outside of Europe. Okay, so this idea that the law is designed to enhance the flow of data is purely within the European market. And though the directive and the regulation does acknowledge that there are benefits from external transfers, but really the entire focus is on protecting the rights of individuals rather than facilitating the transfers outside of Europe. So basically, we have a directive that said and says now still that transfers outside of the European Union are permitted only to countries that are approved by the Commission or which are subject to certain other limited exceptions, which could include consent in some circumstances. Okay. So the Commission took a look at U.S. law and decided that it didn't meet the European standard for, for protecting personal data. And part of that was because the U.S. takes a sector-specific approach. So here in the U.S., we protect personal data really in the financial services industry. We protect health-related personal data. But we don't have an overarching law that protects all personal data. So the European Union and the Commission, the Commission and the U.S. government decided they needed to negotiate a special accord because of the relationship and the importance of trade between the two groups. So they came up with the Safe Harbor Program that was put in place around 2000 to resolve the problem that the U.S. doesn't have an all-encompassing privacy law. And what it basically was a self-certification program administered generally by the FTC. And it had a whole bunch of principles, which were like a sort of a soft, high-level version of European data protection law. It never really drilled down, but you had sort of like the basic themes were all hit. They were all there. And companies would self-certify, and we had about 4,000 companies signed up by 2015. Safe Harbor was particularly important for companies who needed to transfer personal data where consent wasn't viable for legitimizing the transfer. And in particular, under European law, in most European member states, you can't rely on the consent of employees to do anything with their personal data because the local law generally will say, well, employees can't really give consent freely because they'll always be concerned about negative consequences if they say no to their employer. And you can imagine the awkwardness if you're one employee sitting in, say, France, and your company wants to put in a worldwide human resources management system, and you're the one who says, no, not me, right? So they, so basically Safe Harbor was particularly important for transfers of employee data where you can't rely on consent. All right, the Safe Harbor program has a carve-out for U.S. national security, public interest, and law enforcement requirements, okay? That mirrors a carve-out under the European Data Protection Directive for the member states' own national security activities. And this also becomes an important fact. So this directive was put in place in 1995. We got the Safe Harbor Program in 2000. So let's now fast forward to 2013. So in 2013, the Snowden revelations convinced many in Europe that the U.S. intelligence agencies have essentially unconstrained access to massive amounts of personal data of EU origin that has been transferred to the U.S. by various online service providers, including Facebook. And an Austrian lawyer, Max Schrems, who studied for a while at Santa Clara University, brings a complaint against Facebook in Ireland because Facebook has its EU headquarters in Ireland. The complaint boils down to an objection to the transfer of Schrems' data to the U.S., where, per Schrems, there's an inadequate level of protection, as exemplified by the PRISM program, for EU personal data, notwithstanding the fact that the transfer was done under Safe Harbor. So Schrems brings his case to the Irish Data Protection Authority, which is the first port of call if you have a complaint. The Irish Data Protection Authority says it can't do anything because the Commission had adopted this decision back in 2000, endorsing the Safe Harbor program, and the Data Protection Authority is bound by that. So Schrems complains. He goes next to the Irish courts, which is the next step in the chain, and the Irish court says, we don't know. We don't know if European law requires us to say, no, hands off, the Commission made a decision, or not, because we're looking at a fundamental right here. So they kicked the question up to the European Court of Justice, which is the top court in Europe. So in October 2015, the Court of Justice issues their Schrems decision. And this is what they hold. They hold that the Data Protection Authority in Ireland is obligated to hear the complaint because it relates to the protection of fundamental rights. They also held that the U.S. does not provide adequate protection for those fundamental rights. And to arrive at that conclusion, the court relied heavily on the European Commission's own 2013 list of deficiencies that it presented to the U.S. after the Snowden revelations. So basically what happens after Snowden, the Commission decided that they needed to revisit Safe Harbor. They had a lot of very angry Europeans. And they wrote up a list of basically allegations. And those allegations were communicated to the U.S., and they were also communicated in an official, quote-unquote, communication, which is kind of an official document. They were communicated to the European Parliament. And the Court of Justice picked up on that and extensively quoted the Commission's own complaints. In a way that they turned it to basically say, right, well, you know, the Commission has pretty much confessed that the safe harbor framework is not adequate to protect these fundamental rights. Okay. So finally, the Commission decided that safe harbor was invalid from the date of its adoption in 2000 due to the Commission's failure to state in that adoption of safe harbor that the U.S. in fact ensures an adequate level of protection by reason of its domestic laws or its international commitments. But that's a pretty technical ground. What they were really concerned about was that the Safe Harbor Program lacked adequate safeguards and recourse for individuals against U.S. government surveillance. Now, as a lot of people noticed, the European Commission's, the Court of Justice, when they struck down the Safe Harbor decision, so the Commission's decision in the Schrems case, they went well beyond the question asked, but that is their prerogative to do. And that is now the situation that we're stuck with. And I'll just point out that this caused a lot of consternation on the part of U.S. companies, and that the National Data Protection Authorities put their heads together shortly after the decision and said, okay, we understand this is on very short notice, right? We are not going to take enforcement action until the end of January 2016. And the implied ask was that the Commission and the U.S. government sit down and hash out a new framework within that period of time. And there's a lot of complexities there that we'll talk about. But Matthew, that sort of hopefully sets the stage. And happy to talk about that some more. But
no, that's
why don't I jump in, Matt?
Please.
Because I don't really quarrel with Sue's description, except to the extent that she makes it sound like a more rational decision than it really was, and downplays the extent to which it must be based on a profound European elite hostility to the United States. First, it's true there are references to fundamental rights in the context of data protection, and a reference to privacy as a fundamental right in the European fundamental constitutional document on human rights. But the idea that the directive that we're talking about is an outgrowth of constitutional privacy principles, I think, is wrong. It was an attempt to unify and standardize a variety of data protection laws that had been adopted as business regulation around Europe. And that's what's, I think, most important about the data protection rules. They had their origins not as Americans would expect in some kind of Fourth Amendment, a number of privacy notion, but in the notion that commercial entities using personal data needed to be regulated. And the enthusiasm for regulating private industry is greater across the Atlantic than in the United States. And indeed, the enthusiasm for regulating governments is considerably less across the Atlantic than in the United States. And so these were profoundly commercial regulations and had very little to do with how governments handled data. as Sue made clear, there were exemptions for national security in the member states, essentially saying, we're not here to regulate how governments handle this data. We're here to tell you how Ford Motor Company and the banks can handle private data. That's significant, I think, in a couple of ways. First, what the safe harbor did, well, first, the adequacy notion was basically a statement that if the data leaves our shores, we don't know how private companies are going to handle it. They won't be regulated in other jurisdictions unless the other jurisdictions have laws that look like ours. And a few governments did pass laws that looked like Europe's, very few, and got an adequacy seal of approval, but there have been very few governments that have recently obtained that status. The U.S. has strict privacy laws, but only for some sectors, and in other sectors doesn't try to regulate privacy, and particularly inconsistent with the U.S. approach to regulation is what Sue mentioned, the notion that everything is forbidden until it's been approved by a bureaucrat. That is not an American style of regulation, but it is how the European data protection rules work, and we weren't likely to adopt that. So the solution that people came up with, companies came up with, was to say, why don't we promise you that when the data gets to the United States, it'll still be governed by all the rules that would be adopted, that would be applied if the data stayed in the United States. And the safe harbor essentially takes the guts of European data protection rules and allows companies individually to sign up to say, that's what we'll do with this data at all times. What's significant about that is they were making a promise that was the equivalent of what was available to consumers in Europe when they dealt with European companies until this 2013 flap over Snowden led people to begin to say, why can't we also regulate the way the United States government processes data for law enforcement and security purposes? And that's really quite alien to the origins of the data protection laws, but it has acquired a lot of cachet in Europe, and that's what the European Court of Justice bought into, the notion that they should import a bunch of human rights stuff that isn't really in the data protection directive, and then find the United States inadequate because it doesn't provide exactly what European human rights law might require. Actually, it's not clear that European human rights law, or at least the European law that governs the Commission, the European Commission, actually does require all these things. But the European Court of Justice was so eager to strike a blow against the United States that it ignored the fact that it hadn't been asked the question. It ignored the fact that it didn't have any facts. It pulled facts from a negotiating document that had been submitted by the European Commission without any facts of its own to arrive at factual determinations that are almost certainly wrong, and then to cast doubt on this longstanding agreement on which a lot of commerce depends.
So, Sue, what are your thoughts? Was this, you know, is it as Stuart characterizes it, where the court had sort of fanciful notions of what privacy should be, and this was an opportunity to take a shot at the U.S., or do you see this as being more of a neutral, grounded in the facts, and you know, applying the law to the facts decision?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's entirely neutral, but there's what I would say is that I don't see the Schrems decision as issuing out of hostility to the U.S. so much as hostility towards surveillance, generally. So the treaties that make up the European Union have a big carve-out for member state national security, and that's an area that's essentially reserved to the member states. And the Court of Justice has issued opinions in recent years that appears to be applying these fundamental rights of privacy to activities that are really impinging upon member state national security laws. Okay, so
The predecessor case to Schrems is Digital Rights Ireland, which is a purely internal EU case where the Court of Justice struck down a data retention directive that applied to telecoms providers, so all information, all internet and telecoms provider services. And that was struck down. And we have a case pending right now called the Davis case, which the Court of Justice has just agreed to hear at the end of December. They put it on the docket. And this case is basically a British court has kicked up the question to the Court of Justice, basically saying, hey, are you really saying that the Charter of Fundamental Rights and Freedoms has to be taken into consideration and will constrain the national security laws of the member states? And the British court says, we kind of don't think you can do that, but there are these other countries that have assumed that it's the case, and they've already invalidated their own national legislation. So there's a larger division, I think, within Europe between those that are set the balance between privacy and security, way over on the privacy side, and the Court of Justice is on that side. And then you have a lot of member state governments who, you know, post-Paris in particular, are interested in having laws that allow for a greater mass surveillance and hopefully a greater level of security. So I see the divisions there as being a question of setting the balance between privacy versus security, focusing around the question of mass surveillance, and less as direct hostility to the U.S. But I will also say, Stuart, definitely I can, looking at the opinion, it does in many respects look like an attack on the U.S. I agree with that.
I think that's right. You are correct that there is a movement in the always more Europe and never less school of European governance to bring a whole host of constitutional or at least treaty/constitutional rights to bear and to pull them into the European Union, including the economic side of the European Union. So it's an interesting and, I suspect, doomed European effort. But what is significant, I think, is the decision to make the new law and apply it first to the United States. It's as though to draw on a U.S. analogy, the Supreme Court had decided to recognize a right to abortion in a case where they were trying to decide whether women could be allowed to have visas to go to countries that didn't recognize the right to abortion. And they said, no, you can't go there because we consider them to have failed in their human rights efforts, and we don't want American women in countries of that kind. And that, it seems to me, the idea of moving immediately to saying we're going to impose embargoes on countries that don't have exactly the human rights principles that we think are most important is probably the most troubling aspect of this decision.
Yeah, and I'll add on to that the Safe Harbor program, so that's like I said, 4,000 U.S. companies were using it, right? So that's far from everybody. And there are other ways that you can, other legitimate bases for transferring the data. Most of those are also under attack right now. So really, in a sense, the Safe Harbor going down is just the beginning. The other ways that you can transfer data include model clauses, which are standard contract clauses that have been approved by the Commission, again, under one of these decisions. And if you look at those model clauses where the person exporting the data and the person importing the data will sign off on these, there's a representation and warranty to the effect that the party receiving the data is not aware of any local law to which it is subject, which is contrary to all the promises it's making to protect the data to the same level as it would be protected in Europe, right? And so you have these model clauses are still out there, but they're under review by the data protection authorities, and they're very likely to be challenged because as a U.S. company receiving the personal data, if you're aware of the Court of Justice's opinion in Schrems casting doubt upon the adequacy, or actually making a determination, that U.S. law is not adequate for the protection of personal data, you've got a bit of a conundrum in signing off on those clauses. And that's, you know, and then we have consent, right? So consent is another basis for transferring personal data. That is under attack now. So the Schrems case got kicked back to the Irish courts and the Irish DPA, and Schrems duly filed his next series of papers in that case, and he attacks consent on several grounds. But the basic idea is that it's unfair to require someone to waive their fundamental right in exchange for a service. That idea,
I just want to say that's
actually now built into the new regulation that we're going to have in place, which was approved in December, and is going to go into effect in about 2 years.
So I would say that with the possible and limited exception of consent, every form of transfer that a company could rely on is at least at risk. Now, it's at risk because there will be litigation. The litigation will take some years. It'll first go to the DPAs, the data protection authorities, and then eventually to the European Court of Justice, which maybe will rely on facts this time instead of its instincts and desires. But no one will know whether this is going to work for years, and they'll be at risk, especially if they have an aggressive data protection authority that takes advantage of the new fines. The fines could be 2 to 4% of gross global revenue. It's in the billions.
No, that's right. And those fines won't come into effect for the roughly 2 years after official publication, which we're expecting pretty soon. So call it about 2 years. But you still have the risk of fines under the current structure, which vary from country to country. And some of the countries have been passing laws upping the limit on the fines. So, and more than that, you could have direct orders basically backed up potentially by injunctions from the courts to stop data transfers, right?
So, Stuart, if we kind of pivot to the U.S. policymaker, and of course you were once one of those with the Department of Homeland Security, and you were the general counsel of the National Security Agency, what are you thinking as you sit in your office, and how are you thinking about what should the U.S. government's response to these decisions be, both from maybe a commercial point of view and a trade point of view, but as well as a U.S. surveillance point of view, because it does seem that the Schrems decision is trying to use its leverage to curtail U.S. surveillance?
Yeah, I guess I am thinking that the last time our laws were written in a foreign capital, we fought a long war of independence to ensure that would not happen again. This is an act of colonialism or imperialism on the part of the Europeans, and I've negotiated with them over data protection adequacy in the past, and the line that brought down the house was when I said, yeah, take it from me, it never feels like imperialism from the inside. That's what this is, and we've put up with it for quite a while. For 15 years, there have been negotiations in which Europe has said, we want you to change something, and we're going to hold your companies hostage to get you to change it on grounds of adequacy. I think there were at least half a dozen negotiations over travel reservation data, many of which I did, a couple over financial data involving SWIFT. This is the second round for Safe Harbor. It's a well-developed hostage-taking technique on the part of the European Union. The problem this time is that Europe is really screwing around with keeping Americans alive. One of our undisputedly most effective intelligence programs involves using data that crosses our border maybe just to sit on a server, maybe just to cross the border through a switch or a router in order to find terrorists and thwart their plots. And all of that data is at risk. The programs are at risk if people begin saying, I don't dare deal with the United States. I don't dare let my data move from the country it's in. We will be much slower to find plots if we find them at all. And so for the first time, Europeans are starting to trench on a true national security priority with this approach. And my guess is that for the first time, Congress and the intelligence agencies are going to begin digging in on this and saying, no, we're not going to do this. And the kinds of remedies I would be considering if I were dealing with Europe on this is I would say, you know, just in the last month, maybe 6 weeks at this point, the French have thanked us for information we provided about the attacks in Paris, and the Germans have acted on intelligence we gave them about a New Year's Eve bombing threat from Munich train station that thwarted what we believe was an attack. This is information that Europe depends on, and yet at the same time that Europe is attacking the tools for gathering it. So maybe we should just say we're not going to share intelligence data, including terrorist intelligence data, with countries that are getting in the way of our ability to actually collect it. So that's certainly one possibility. The other possibility is to take hostages of our own and to say that the transatlantic trade investment partnership won't go forward if this issue, which is probably the number one trade barrier between the U.S. and Europe, isn't resolved in it, which Europe has always resisted fiercely doing. They would rather have these one-off negotiations than deal with it in a larger context. So my guess is that the U.S. is digging in pretty hard. On the other hand, the European Commission has been partially neutered by this decision. They don't have quite as much authority as they used to, thanks to the European Court of Justice. Plus, they have promised to consult with the European Parliament, which is, if anything, a little more anti-American than the Commission and the European Court of Justice, and which will probably say no to whatever the European Commission brings to it, at least the first time. So my guess is it's going to be very hard to negotiate a deal. I'd love to see one, but only if the Europeans back off many of their efforts to regulate U.S. National security issues.
And on that point, Sue, with regard to the seeming disconnect between perhaps what individual member state governments in the EU want to do in terms of cooperating with the U.S. on surveillance or other intelligence activities, and what they're doing with regard, and you mentioned this earlier, with France increasing its surveillance authorities, is anyone on the European scene, either at, you know, at a political level, talking about the seeming disconnect between behaviors and acts of individual European member states versus pronouncements from the European Court of Justice or perhaps the European Parliament?
Well, what you mostly see in the media, I would say, are more the pro-privacy statements, the anti-surveillance pro-privacy statements, which, you know, it would, you know, like to see the Court of Justice viewpoint kind of, you know, adopted by the member states, right? So they'd like to see the Davis case come down and with a decision saying that, you know, notwithstanding all the treaties, that these fundamental rights have to be applied by the member states to their own mass surveillance activities for national security purposes. So it's just a very difficult thing right now. I think it's something that no one wants to talk about publicly, and we're not seeing that much, really, but it needs to be discussed. And I think the Davis case is going to force
force the conversation, right? Because if the Davis case comes down and it says, you know, the Court of Justice says, yes, you know, our decisions in Digital Rights Ireland and Schrems actually apply to the member states' national laws, then you've got a major sovereignty issue. You've got a question of expanding the powers of the European Union via the Court of Justice to the member states in an area that's expressly reserved to the member states under the treaties, right? So you've got a big, big sovereignty issue. If they come back and say that, well, no, okay, so we can, yeah, after all, you know, everything that the member states do for national, their own national security, that is, you know, we cannot opine on that, and the Charter of Fundamental Rights and Freedoms doesn't apply, et cetera, then you're going to have a different kind of conversation, and that's where I think that you'll really be able to, you know, internationally, we'll be able to flag up the huge disparity. But what it comes down to, really, is that, you know, there's a huge carve-out for national security right now, right, assuming the Davis Appeals Court is right and that the Court of Justice decisions don't constrain it, the national security laws. There's a huge carve-out for the member state national security that just doesn't apply to the U.S. And the way that it has been articulated by the Court of Justice is going to be extremely difficult to get past. And I've thought about, you know, different things. So like now the Judicial Redress Act that's pending in the Senate, you know, the commissioner, Vera Jourova, who has been negotiating the new Safe Harbor 2.0, as everyone's calling it, has said it's a step in the right direction. But everyone has to be really clear. That itself is not going to meet the Safe Harbor standard for a couple of reasons, one of which is that it doesn't provide protection for non-citizen residents of the EU, right? So there's one big gaping hole right there. And then secondly, once you start drilling down on what the actual rights are that are being offered to EU citizens, you still come up against carve-outs for U.S. national security agencies. Right? So it's not really going to get the job done. And so I think we sort of have two options now within the European Union. We could have a negotiation that about redress rights and also tailoring surveillance activities, two aspects of what you need to have to meet the Schrems standard. We could have that negotiation. It would have to be out, you know, beyond the scope of the Judicial Redress Act. You could kind of imagine that that negotiation could happen. It would need to be truly bilateral, right, truly mutual, because right now I'm not confident that that U.S. citizens actually have recourse in member states under their national laws against surveillance activities that might be excessive or, you know, incorrect information that's held about them, et cetera. But you could imagine that. And the other option, and I don't have a whole lot of, you know, I can imagine it, but just barely, right? The other option would be the court revisiting all of this, in possibly in light of a different sense of the facts, as Stuart was pointing earlier, in light of a more up-to-date understanding of what U.S. National intelligence laws actually allow, the role of the FISA court, for example, and the changes that have been implemented in the U.S. since 2013. And at this point, I think that we kind of need a new Court of Justice case, ultimately, that allows a little more, gives a little more credit to the protections available in the U.S. And puts a little less weight you know, on media reports, and maybe just sets the balance a little bit differently.
Well, let me offer some thoughts about how this is likely to come out. And I think it's highly significant that, as I said, we've had almost a dozen crisis negotiations where Europe said, we're going to cut off access to this data. And not once has data been cut off. The reason is no responsible European government official actually wants to cut it off. They want the threat, not the actuality, sort of the way Kim Jong-un wants the threat of nuclear weapons. He doesn't want to use them, or so we hope. And, you know, maybe he's crazy enough, maybe the European Court of Justice is crazy enough to actually try to use this weapon, but that is a potentially very risky outcome for both of them, because in many cases, companies will simply stop obeying the law and will move the data anyway. It'll be very hard to enforce. Or they'll actually carry out the data, cut off the data flows and move as much of their operations out of Europe as they possibly can, so as not to be inconvenienced by the data embargo. Not a good outcome for Europe as well. So I think it is unlikely that anybody who follows this closely actually wants the data to stop moving. That will, I think, encourage a solution, at least at the European Commission level. And there's a solution here available. It is not that hard to come to the conclusion that anything that the European Court of Justice has said about the meaning of the Data Protection Directive in the context of governments, anything they've said, the United States has met. Even the dumb things that they said based on the dumb things the European Commission had said, because the European Commission was operating off of press releases and a determination to find fault, not an actual detailed understanding of how the U.S. handles its intelligence information. So it would be possible, even under current U.S. law, to go back and credibly say, we think we meet the requirements that the court has set for data protection. We think the U.S. meets them, and therefore we're going to allow data flows to continue. That is, I think, a very likely outcome.
And Stuart, how does that outcome come to fruition? Is it by the vehicle of another case? Is it a political resolution? Maybe Sue, you could comment as well.
Well, I will offer my thoughts. I think there will be a negotiation, a full-fledged agreement. The agreement will largely meet at least an appropriate interpretation of the directive and U.S. law, and that will be served up to the European Parliament and eventually a challenge to that determination will go forward, but it will take another couple of years to wend its way through the data protection authorities of the member states and then to the European Court of Justice. And at that point, I think the European Court of Justice will have the opportunity, though they might not take it, to say, okay, now that we understand U.S. law and we've seen the representations of the European Commission, we think that the U.S. law is equivalent to European law.
Oh. And Sue, does that seem like a potential path to you? Or?
Yeah, I think it's a potential path. The standard is very, very high. So the standard that would be required would be that the U.S. would need to have laws protecting Europeans, not just citizens, so not just what the Judicial Redress Act provides for. The laws would have to be specific, strictly restricted, and capable of justifying the interference with the individual's privacy rights. Okay, and it would also have to include a means for EU residents to challenge the collection of their personal data and to obtain redress. Right, the surveillance would have to be narrowly targeted. Right, so it essentially, mass surveillance is just kind of out, right? So I understand what Stuart is proposing. I think that it's certainly a potential out, but it would also require the Court of Justice to back down a bit from its very stringent interpretation and anti-mass surveillance attitudes.
Yeah.
So it would require.
I completely agree with that. The court will have to back off some, but my guess is they will if the commission comes in full-throated defending the second safe harbor agreement, which they probably will do because the alternative is pretty disastrous.
Yeah. So going on to those alternatives, I mean, I think what's happening in the meantime, and Stuart, you pointed out that these challenges will take time to percolate from the data protection authorities to the national courts onto the Court of Justice. And there's a long period of uncertainty.
U.S. companies are facing huge pressure now to move all of their data centers to the European Union to deal with their European data. And we're seeing a lot of that already. And, you know, I think that, you know, unfortunately, that's almost, it's just a really awkward situation that American companies have put in, and they're you know, doing as much risk mitigation as they can, and we're going to see more of that going forward.
Well, I think on that note, we'll just, Tim, I think it's time we're open to doing some question and answer, and we've got about 15 minutes left in the call. Are there any questions in the queue?
Yeah, let me open the floor to questions right now. In a second, we're going to hear a prompt that says the floor mode is on. After you hear that, you just press star and then the pound key on your telephone, and you'll hop right in line. We'll get to the questions in the order that we receive them. So I'm going to open the lines right now.
Great.
So while we wait for some questions to queue up, let me make a note really quick about our upcoming programming. The next Teleform is on the 25th of January at 1 o'clock. It's about the False Claims Act and the Pablo Escobar case. Then on the 26th, also at 1 o'clock, we're going to have our telecom transactions teleforum. And the last scheduled one we have is on the 27th at 2 o'clock about corporate inversions. And with that, we're going to move ahead to the first audience caller. Go ahead, caller.
I have two questions. One is, what if they don't come to an agreement at the end of the month? What happens then? And then two, Sue, what is the practical result of the pressure that you say the American companies are feeling to bring their operations into Europe? You know, how soon can that happen, and how does that manifest itself just sort of logistically? Thanks.
Yeah. Okay, sure. So basically, the National Data Protection Authority, sort of speaking through the Article 29 Working Party, which consists of the heads of those national DPAs, has said, look, we're going to start, we won't start enforcing until the end of January. So now we're facing the risk that there will be fines and that there will be actual bans on data transfers for companies that are continuing to rely only on Safe Harbor. Now, most companies, I would guess, based on what I've seen with my own clients, many companies will already have put in place alternate mechanisms. So the model contracts that I referred to being one of the main ones. So hopefully by the time enforcement rolls around for people who are still relying only on Safe Harbor, hopefully there aren't going to be too many targets out there. But there is a real chance of significant fines, not as big as under the new regulation, but still potentially significant fines and orders banning data transfers.
I would only say that if you're asking who's at greatest risk, obviously there's a public list of Safe Harbor companies so that the data protection authorities can just go to the list and see if they have anybody in their jurisdiction who's on the list. Everybody there is at substantial risk. And any company that was associated publicly with the U.S. program is also gravely at risk because of the determination on the part of the data protection authorities to utilize these authorities to attack U.S. intelligence collection, particularly the 702 program.
Yeah, I think your large, you know, what they call information society services providers, so Google, Facebook, Yahoo, those sets, they're the ones who are going to probably be in the initial sights of the regulators, and that one's just they're obvious targets. So I agree with that. In terms of, you know, the what's involved in moving data, kind of data hosting services, et cetera, over to the EU. So this is an option that for two sets of companies can do this without too much trouble. If you're a really large company and you've got a lot extensive operations in Europe, having your own data centers there and starting to segregate your activities may work for you. And then there's companies that are, you know, where their model would allow the use of, you know, cloud service providers located solely in the European Union. But then when it comes down to, you know, what you actually need to do with that data, and does it work for your operation to do that, you know, the answer to that ranges from, okay, it's an increased cost, right, to actually this really hampers our business model. And it's the companies in that second set that are really need to find alternate ways to deal with the problem.
On that note, Sue, and I put this to both you and Stuart, is there anything in the commentary, the court's opinion, or at least anyone else observing it, that rather than talking about the fundamental nature of data privacy, is anyone opining that what may really be driving this is some sort of call it data mercantilism or data nationalism, where part of the court's motivation and part of those that are being so adamant about the protection of data also see it as a vehicle to foster European industry around data and management of data, because it does seem to be an economic advantage to start forcing U.S. firms to host data in Europe if you're a European.
I would say that there's no question that that's going on here. Deutsche Telekom was aggressive in seeking out cloud business precisely on the ground that they could keep it in Europe and others couldn't, and therefore they should get the cloud business even if it cost a little bit more. And indeed, data protection mercantilism has been a feature of data protection law since the 1970s, when it first was put forward, and French officials used to say, well, this is, you know, keeping the data at home is an important part of keeping the jobs at home. And so that has certainly been an undercurrent in all of these discussions.
Yeah, so my take on that is that the economic protectionism is a maybe welcomed side effect, but not the driver. I really do think that there's a huge divide in Europe between the you know, the very, very strong privacy protectionists and those that, you know, don't set the balance as far out as the protectionists do. But I do think that it's a side effect that has been noted and that a lot of people in Europe who stand to benefit are happy about.
There is also an interesting additional side effect that governments like Brazil, when they wanted data localization, were very alive to, which is if the data is stored in country and you're investigating somebody who has a Yahoo Mail account, you just go to Yahoo in country and say, since that data's got to be stored here, cough it up, and I don't need no stinking warrants, which is largely true in Europe. Whereas currently, if they have a Yahoo account, the investigators have to ask the United States to go through a pretty cumbersome and rights-protective process before the information is handed over. So the irony here is there is some law enforcement enthusiasm for data localization, not because it will make privacy stronger, but because it will make privacy weaker.
Yeah, the efficiency of investigations gets heightened.
All right, what was I thinking? Yeah, that's what I meant.
Tim, are there any other questions in the queue?
There are none queued up right now, but I would remind the audience that to request the floor, just enter star and the pound key on your telephone. Seeing none, if any of our contributors have anything else to contribute, then we can wait for them to queue up.
Why don't we just take the time? I'll put one last question to our contributors. So Stuart and Sue, you're both in private practice, so you're obviously serving clients. How are you coaching your companies through this scenario? What, you know, I know, Sue, you sort of talked about some companies thinking about localizing data. Is the advice to sort of, you know, just put a pause on things and see where things sort themselves out? I know some companies, such as my own, are very busy implementing model clauses. I'm just wondering, what are you telling businesses that are sort of caught in the crossfire?
Well, you know, this is kind of frustratingly for a lawyer, there's not that much room for creative solutions. There's a prescribed slate of things that you can pick of what's left, right? And so we are largely counseling many clients to move to the model clauses, which can be a very cumbersome process due to the fact that there's no the whole relation of sub-processing out or the subcontract out requires a whole mess of contracts. But model clauses is sort of the top favorite, backed up by consent wherever at all feasible, right? So obtaining it. So even if you know, even if consent falls, maybe model clauses will stand or vice versa, right? And then there is that, you know, the, you know, ultimately just not doing a transfer, you know, keeping the data in Europe. But again, for some clients, this just isn't viable. It just won't work for their business model. And we're certainly telling them, and we've been telling them from the very beginning, to take action as soon as possible for a lot of reasons, right? So there's minimizing the risk of enforcement, but then there's also looking at, you know, the client's other interests, which is, you know, complying with contracts, which will often have requirements relating to compliance with law, and lawfulness of activities and things like that. And, you know, maybe getting a company ready for an acquisition, so thinking about potential diligence and not wanting to have gaping holes of noncompliance there. So it's definitely not a wait-and-see situation. It's you know, go to the next best alternatives and hope that a more robust solution is negotiated between the governments.
Well, I agree with all of that. You have to have a plan. You have to be able to explain what you're doing. If you can fit this into the model clauses, that's a great idea. If you can fit it into consent, that's a great idea. Stretching consent won't work in theory, but I have to say, and this is a delicate thing for a lawyer, but the fact is that enforcement is not the strong suit of European data protection authorities, and it's certainly not going to be their strong suit when they have 4,000 new targets to be shooting at. And they do what the FTC does. They pick a few targets and try to make a big deal out of hitting them. And so you really have to spend some effort trying to avoid being a target and having a plausible first level response to questions about what you're doing to comply with TRIMS. And if there are holes, if it won't stand up to deep scrutiny, frankly, I'd do it anyway because you may not get deep scrutiny. And that's not a comfortable thing, but frankly, the Europeans put us in this position by adopting a law that says everything you're doing is illegal unless we've expressly exempted it, and we're writing exemptions that no one qualifies for. So that would just be the realist gloss that I would put on top of what is otherwise an awkward set of legal options.
Yeah, that's right. I'll add one more just for completeness, which is the binding corporate rules, which work for transfers within a corporate group. But you have to bear in mind that those can take up to 18 months or even more to be approved, so it's not a solution that's going to, you know, you can put into place quickly. And then the one thing I would add to Stuart's comment, so I do think that, you know, prosecutions are going to have to be very selective at the beginning, but let's remember that we have this new regulation coming into play in about 2 years, and the fine structure under that new regulation is going to be amazingly different. The top fines can be up to 4% of a group's global turnover, gross revenue. So these are modeled on fines. They're huge fines. And in some countries, those fines will go fairly directly into funding more enforcement activity. And in any case, the new regulation requires all countries to adequately finance the enforcement arm of their data protection authorities. So I think that for the time being, realistically, the threat of enforcement may not be huge, right? But we're definitely moving in the direction of a regulation that has huge, sharp teeth and the, you know, the political will to bite hard.
I will say my clients would be happy to get through the next 2 years and worry about what happens then.
Well, on that note, I want to thank both Stuart and Sue for a very interesting conversation on a topic that clearly is not going to go away, however it eventually resolves itself. And I think it's an interesting topic because you do see the clear intersection between commerce, people that have a very strong view of what data privacy should be, and then surveillance authority and national security interests. So I thank you both for a very interesting conversation. With that, Tim, I turn it over to you to close this out.
Thank you very much. I'd like to echo Mr. Hyman's thanks to Mr. Baker and Ms. Foster. Please do join us on January 25th for our next teleforum, which again is on the False Claims Act and the Pablo Escobar case. Thanks also to our audience and everyone who joined. And we always welcome your feedback by email at info@fed-soc.org. Hope to hear from you all again. With that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.